Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Ben Reed, and tonight, spring begins in Scotland as we continue with Jonathan Johnson's memoir, The Desk on the Sea, read by the author.
Crail. Daffodils along dry stone walls, up steep braes, yellow in the wind. Morning silhouette of a lone figure in an outboard skiff, riding a silver V of sun on the blue and silver sea. Dove voice down the chimney. Translucence of a tilting gull's wing. A single filament of spiderweb shining in the corner window pane. Spotty bright film of dry brine from the spray of a storm last winter on the glass. Floating gulls that turn like little swans in the shimmer pattern of breeze through the harbor. Dry rope of creels stacked on the pier and on boats. Wet rope of slack tie lines where they curve through the surface. Pale to white green lichen and deep green moss on the garden wall's rock. 10 million colors the human eye can read while it lives, and every color sun. The first lambs are somewhere in the hills, and the hills are sprouting grass. Like no place else I know, Scotland can turn mournful to wondrous as swiftly and truly as the human heart. The sky will be low and close, the sea a gray that insists it will outlast you, the slopes shrouded in mist, the skin of every woebegone thing wet, everything elegy. And then, at evening, the clouds will move and shred in layers of altitude, will open but close again, disassembling whatever skies above until finally giving over to let in the gloaming and then the stars. The morning will rise on a coast so bright it's as if nothing ever need die. It's an ancient fallacy to say so, I know, but Scotland seems to understand. March ends today. Guests go. Our friend Chris and her children, Dylan and Hallie, back to home and work and school in America. And guests come, Amy's folks again, with grandparent hugs for Anya and stories of 300 inches of snowfall so far and 3 feet of ice on the lake at their secluded log home near Marquette. Meanwhile, more daffodils than I ever knew existed bloom in the Scottish sun, every one of them an ambassador from where my mother has gone. If I could film any 10 seconds of this life and somehow send those 10 seconds to my mother, it might well be these. Anya is on a blonde horse. Her ponytail bobs up and down and blows in the wind as the horse trots and wind blows across its tail and blonde mane. Girl and horse cross the newly green field in front of the farm, just outside Crail, where Anya takes riding lessons. Up one side of the field, a row of centuries-old maples, still winter bare. Up the opposite side, another row of centuries-old maples, also still winter bare, but with daffodils speckled beneath. Out beyond the field and stone fences, the open sea and the Isle of May. Here, where I watch in front of the old stone farmhouse, more daffodils than I have ever seen in one place. Thousands of them, tilting and leaning with the spring breeze. If I could, I would show my mother 10 seconds of this so she could see her one grandchild this confident on her saddle, in the world, with herself, surrounded by so much beauty, a moving painting in the leaning light when afternoon turns to evening. And then, when Anya has ridden over to her instructor Alice at the fence, and I think this moment I would send is complete, I hear Alice ask Anya if she's ever ridden bareback. Not here, Anya says, as an involuntary grin spreads across her face. Anya climbs down, Alice removes the saddle, boosts Anya back up, and Anya and horse walk back out into my mother's dream. Spring is Scotland's most insistent season, and what the spring in Scotland insists on is now. Grass grows among the ruins. This year's lambs call out and kick and scurry as the only lambs the world will ever know, never mind the stone fence around the pasture and the netherworld from which it came. Every place grows from its own remains, but nowhere else I've been seems so indifferent in its own growing from such enduring remains. Do we call this time Easter and see resurrection in it because we could never stand to see the way the new is not the old recovered, but in fact obliterates the old? The fledgling leaves of a little urban elm reflecting up off the hood of a Mini Cooper parked at the curb next to my St. Andrew's Cafe table have never been before. Sure, the tree itself comes back into green, but never the leaves. The boy who toddles by, holding some big person's hand and gives me a passing glance, is no other boy who has ever been. He is completely new, and all of history's children before him are nowhere to be seen today. Today is his. So how does one mourn in a spring like Scotland's spring? Where does one find the dead? One doesn't. They aren't out there among the gulls and waves, the new children and leaves, the tweed-coated scholars studying at their chrome cafe tables in the sun. In the spring, one mourns not by seeking the dead, but by thanking them. This is the world into which our dead wished us, a kind of afterlife not for them, but for us. And as is so obvious along the cobblestone lanes and ancient sheep fields and flowering ruins of Scotland, it is the way of the world that this new day is possible, this new life has a chance, only because the old has gone and made way. Regretlessly, like my mother, or otherwise, the dead have gone just the same. And we may consider that a gesture on their part. For if their days never went, this day would never have come. For these children to feel the sun on their faces, each child who came before has given up the sun. Spring is Scotland's most insistent season, and it insists on now. Scotland does not insist that we feel gratitude for those who gave up this moment, that we even pay them a passing thought as we sit in today's sun. But by doing so, I feel the sun as that much warmer, and see these new little leaves as that much more intricate and fine. I thank my mother and all the children who had their days once for that passing boy's face. Amy's folks have gone back to Michigan once again, but my cousin Jennifer will be staying a little while longer. In the morning, as I write at my desk by the window, I can often hear her and Anya through the door, playing roles and making up scenarios. "Tonks," I just heard Jennifer admonish. "We can't let the muggles see you like this, a purple cheetah." Anya replied with a high-pitched cheetah squeak of happy unconcern. At dusk, Jennifer often goes out walking the coast path and gathering driftwood in sacks, the wind in over the waves across her long, curly yellow hair. She comes home and builds the evening fire with her finds, then sits up close to the fireplace, warming her hands as the salty wood snaps with silver sparks, crackles, and burns bright gold. Last night, the rest of us joined her on her driftwood walk. We got as far as the ruined cottage before we turned back with our sacks full and the daylight all but drained from the air around us. At home, Jennifer built the fire. We all played a quick game of cards, then took turns reading Harry Potter aloud. As we tucked Anya into bed, it occurred to me that Jennifer and Anya are only a dozen years apart in age. One day, God willing a long time from now, after Amy and I are gone, Anya will have Jennifer to remember Crail with. To remember gathering driftwood out by the ruined cottage in the dusk, as gulls turned and waves spilled over the rocks and rattled the stones on the beach. To remember saying goodnight to the lighthouse out the window, and the sound of those waves outside in the dark as we read Harry Potter and the cottage filled with the homey smell of salty wood crackling in the fireplace. Notice April. Notice everything about April you can. I tell myself this in our garden, which slopes up the hill behind our cottage to a weathered picnic table at which I sit in the sun and look out over our mossy tiled roof and the harbor and sea beyond. New leaves and new blooms surround me, the smell of roses, The cheeping and cawing and peeping and twittering of birds comes from 7 different directions when I close my eyes and count. The sea is calm. The slosh of the littlest waves of the reef and seawall drifts up to me. Is this the destination, then? Yesterday, as Jennifer and I drove back from a marathon I'd run in the Highlands, we debated the question of whether the point of life is really the journey, my position, or the destination, her position. We often make a game of arguing such inane questions, and she generally enjoys taking the side contrary to whatever homespun wisdom is up for discussion. She's such a wise and patient young person, it's amusing to hear her take contrary or cynical positions. She knows this, of course, and enjoys the effect. "Think about it," she said as the dark mountains sloped around us in the dusk and our headlights followed the curving road along rock walls and through overhanging tree limbs. "If living was all about the journey, nobody'd ever get anything done. Everyone would just, you know, keep moving with no point." There is nobody I know less concerned with getting to the point and more contented to enjoy the moving than Jennifer. It's part of what makes her such great company. She delights just about every day in simply seeing what the day brings. But I played along and did my best to argue her out of her put-on cynicism. "Think about a good marriage," I said. "In a good marriage, there's no end point in the future toward which you're striving, no finish line when things will be right. At least there shouldn't be. A good marriage is about every day." "Then that's the goal, isn't it? That's the destination?" "Now you're just talking semantics." "No," she said, as if aghast at the inference, "I'm not. If you have a goal that things will be good every day in a marriage, say, when you get married, and then things are good, you're at your destination." "Undergrads," I said, exasperated. "Old people." "Old people? Sorry, I couldn't think of anything else fast enough. Don't worry, though. People are living a lot longer nowadays." Now, sitting amid 7 directions of birdsong in the garden, the sun warming my shoulders, I wonder if Jennifer may have had a genuine point. This does feel more like an arrival than a journey. Maybe that's just what spring does. Maybe part of spring's insistence is to seem like the whole point of there being seasons at all. Maybe it's not just semantics. Maybe in her playfulness, Jennifer hit on some real wisdom. Maybe each good day is not actually part of a journey. Maybe each good day is itself a destination, an accomplishment, the place toward which you've been heading all along. This morning is so ordinary. A little while ago, we got Anya off to school in her blue uniform, red coat, and green backpack. She's recently had a haircut and now has bangs, fringe, as they call it here. I had to lift the fine blonde hair to plant a kiss on the warm skin of her forehead. Jennifer made avocado sandwiches for herself and Amy. I gave Amy a squeeze and a kiss, and they were out the door, Jennifer to the library, and Amy to do some volunteer social work. I fixed myself a hot chocolate, climbed the stairs to my desk at the window, and turned on Classic FM. The famous La Donna e Mobile aria from Rigoletto filled the room. Poor Rigoletto never saw it coming. It's cloudy and the sea is calm. The tide is out and the fishing boats are in, their hulls resting on the sheen of mud in the harbor. Ordinary. A gloriously ordinary day. But what today might have been is an abyss at the back of my psyche. Yesterday, on our way to Anya's horseback riding lesson, we drove past a temporary sign propped on a tripod beside the rock wall fence. In white letters, on a blue metal background, were the words, "Serious accident here, April 23rd, police appeal for witnesses." A teenage girl from the village, we'd heard. An only child. We've been living here 9 months, but we don't know her family. Most of the people we've met since moving to Scotland have primary school-age children, like us. No doubt we've seen her, though. No doubt often. Up at the bakery or the fish and chip shop, or at the Christmas tree lighting party on the square, or walking with her friends along the stone seawall that encircles the tiny harbor out our cottage windows. But we won't even know which of the young faces is missing. Wouldn't even know there was one fewer if we hadn't been told. All I had to offer was the thought, poor someone and her poor, poor parents. As we passed the sign and drove on through farm fields overlooking the North Sea, Anya's teacher Alice and the horses at Barnesmere Farm were waiting. "We're going to canter today," Anya said from the back seat. She could hardly contain herself. When Anya had started her lessons last autumn, I'd been afraid. I always smiled and waved from behind the fence or from the parked car where Amy and I watched when she went by. And mostly I was able to push from my head the lines of Theodore Ruthke's poem, Elegy for Jane, my student, thrown by a horse. Every now and then, though, when I gave a thumbs up, or Amy took a picture of Anya sitting upright and trying not to smile beneath her helmet, a few of Ruthke's words slipped in. I remember the neck curls, her quick look. Yes, I am a man who lives with, or perhaps more accurately, who lives in spite of, a chronic awareness of potential disaster and the bottomless grief that is always threatening to open beneath every moment. Yes, my entire adult life until I was 36, I was periodically reminded by rapid and terrifying turns in my mother's precarious health that one's ordinary days could quite unceremoniously and brutally be taken away. A little fatigue could be the first sign of another heart attack. The onset of a mild fever might be the initial symptom of another life-threatening infection. Time after time, I was reminded, grief waits. Everywhere, always. No one is safe, ever. It's true. And yet, I choose to live without cowering. Well, usually without cowering. Sometimes, the words of Ruthke's poem whisper in my brain. If only I could nudge you from this sleep, my maimed darling. Sometimes fear rules me, but not usually. Anya fell once, earlier in the spring. It was a rainy day, so lessons were in an indoor arena near the farm. She was learning to jump, which is really just a little hop on the horse's part, over a bar maybe 10 inches high. She'd been thrilled to have done it so well the previous lesson, and as she and the roan pony Blossom headed for the jump, her face was full of as much determination and confidence as I could remember seeing in any 8-year-old. But Blossom decided it wasn't enough determination and confidence and stopped suddenly just before the bar, sending Anya sliding off. Amy gasped and held her hand to her mouth, but she stood her ground beside me. My wife is a tomboy, used to a little risk and rough and tumble. She didn't grow up with a mom in fragile health, but in a family of downhill skiers and unflappable medical professionals who weren't about to flinch at every little bump and scrape. But it was everything I could do not to run to Anya, to stay standing in place, even though she was well clear of the horse's hooves and the fall hadn't looked too bad. The arena floor was 4 merciful inches deep with shredded rubber, and sure enough, Anya was on her feet in a moment, climbing back up on the horse with the help of one of Alice's teenage teaching assistants before I could have reached her had I dashed over. And instead of suffering the embarrassing scene I'd have made, she'd gotten a nice round of applause from the other girls and cleared the little jump on her next pass. Her first tumble had been a success for both Anya and me, and it was behind us. If anything, my fear watching the subsequent lessons eased a bit. It was possible for Anya to take a fall and be fine. So even after passing that sign at the scene of the car wreck and sparing a thought for the poor someone I didn't know and her poor parents, I wasn't paying all that much mind to danger, to the unrelenting possibility for ruin. In fact, I was doing a bit of reveling in just how well everything was going for us since we'd moved here and in the beauty of this moment. Amy and I were sitting in the car just beyond a few hundred blossoming daffodils at the edge of the sunny pasture, watching Anya and a couple of other girls walking their ponies in a circuit while the blue sea rose beyond them. They stepped their horses over a couple of low jumps and wove them slowly between poles and curved around and repeated the route. The wind lifted the horses' manes and tails and the girls' hair where it trailed from their helmets. I looked down at the postcard I was writing to a friend. It was rather self-congratulatory, I admitted to myself, full of as much of our lucky life as I could fit. "Good jump, Anya," Amy said with enthusiasm and encouragement, as if Anya could have actually heard her from 100 yards across the windy field. Apparently, the walkthrough portion of the lesson was over. I put my postcard on the dash and looked up. My eyes scanned for Anya's red jacket and the white horse she was riding this time, Woody. A gray horse, I reminded myself. Alice had taught the girls that almost all white horses are properly called grays. Alice is about 40, around the same age as Amy and me. She is lean and beautiful and speaks with a refined English accent. She manages to seem poised in green, knee-high Wellington boots, a chore coat, and a bill cap. Like Amy, she is both gently kind and tough. Like my mom, too, it has occurred to me. But when Anya started lessons with her, what mattered most about Alice to me was that we had asked around and heard she was the best riding instructor in our part of Scotland. And sure enough, she exuded the abilities and knowledge of someone who had known horses all her life. "Well done, you!" I could faintly hear her call to Anya, whom I spotted on Woody just as he was coming down from another jump. But there was a shriek, and then Woody was running faster, a scream, Anya screaming. Woody bolted, ran flat out, and Anya was screaming, "Mommy!" screaming, screaming, the horse down hard into its run, air whipping its mane back as it shot dangerously across the field with Anya on its back. Nothing I could do, nothing, nothing. The horse wasn't slowing, but running thunderously, and Anya was screaming. Amy and I ran from the car and sprinted toward the fence. The horse was running this way, but in a curve so the fence wouldn't slow him. "Mommy!" Anya screamed and bounced and jostled and clung on. She was in horrible danger. My child, my Anya. "Whoa, whoa, whoa!" I called as I ran, forcing my tone to be firm, not panicky. But was the horse slowing? I couldn't tell. And I couldn't will the horse to slow. I couldn't will this to end okay. It just kept happening in front of me. Amy and I reached the step over at the fence and saw Anya fall off and the horse keep running away from where Anya hit the ground. We were over the fence and running toward her. "Please, oh please, oh please let her stand up." And she stood up, wailing. We reached her. "Mommy," she cried in Amy's arms. I scanned her, angled around to see her face, her eyes. "I don't want to do that again. I don't. She was hysterical. "It's okay, baby. Baby, you're okay. You're all right, Anya," we said. "Let me check you over, sweetheart," I said. She limped slightly as she stepped back into a looser embrace with Amy. But what's a limp? I took her helmet off. I touched her head gently, her neck. I pressed my fingers on her abdomen, feeling for hard spots. I looked closely into her tear-welled eyes. She was standing. She was crying and talking. She hugged Amy again and sobbed. Alice had reached us by now. I don't want to do that again. Anya. "No one's saying anything about that," Alice said with firm reassurance, though I could hear real fear under her words. "We just want to check you out." Alice looked her over. "You landed on your legs, yes?" Anya nodded. "You didn't hit your head?" "No." "Or your body, your torso?" I added. "No." Amy kept hold of her. "Where did you hit?" I asked. Anya pointed to her hip and the side of her thigh where flecks of grass were smeared into her riding breeches. "That's good," Alice said. I wrapped Amy and Anya in my arms, and the smell of Anya's hair came to me with my breath. She was still here, still Anya, unbroken. A few steps, and her limp was gone. A couple minutes more, and Alice asked if she wanted to get back on Woody. "If you want to," Alice said a second time. "What? Back on?" I asked myself. "Only if you want to," Amy and I both added. The moment of truth was not just Anya's. "Alice can lead you," I said, as though it were just a suggestion, while in my racing mind it was an absolute requirement. The best thing to do after falling from a horse may be to get straight back on, but no way I was going to let that happen without Alice's firm grip on this horse's lead. "That's right, Anya," Alice agreed. "I'll keep hold the whole time." "It's your choice," Amy repeated. "We can be done for the day and come back next time if you want." "I want to stay," she wiped away her tears. "Can I ride some more? Is that okay?" "Of course it is, Anya," Alice said. "Good girl." "Of course you can, baby," Amy repeated. The best I could do was a nod and a weak, "Sure." Alice's teenage assistant fetched Woody from across the field. Alice clipped on the lead. Then Anya followed Alice's example and stroked the horse's nose and neck. Then Anya's shin was in Alice's cupped hands, and Alice was hoisting my child, my sweet child, the most direct evidence I know of divinity, back onto that horse. As promised, Alice walked them back to the poles and jumps and never let go of the lead as she, Woody, and Anya walked around the circuit. Subdued by what they'd seen, the other girls also spent these last few minutes of the lesson walking their horses. Amy and I stood in the field, unwilling to retreat back to the car. We passed a few quiet comments back and forth. She would have been just as happy to go home and never let Anya near a horse again. But she thought it was good that Anya wanted to get back on. I agreed with both positions. "That was so horrible," I added. Amy's expression collapsed, and she held her hand to her mouth. Tears rolled down her cheeks. "I was so helpless. She was screaming for me." I put my arm around her. "She's okay," I said. "But God, that was horrible." Amy nodded. She took a sidestep away from me. She was determined to keep herself together for Anya's sake for the moment. I felt the soft, rockless grass under my feet, looked over at two big, jagged logs not 20 yards away.
Thank you for listening to The Bookshelf on Spokane Public Radio. If you missed an episode, you can catch up online at spokanepublicradio.org or on the Bookshelf podcast. That marks the end of tonight's episode of The Desk on the Sea, written and read by Jonathan Johnson. The music for this episode is by Caerdwin and Greg Spatz. I'm Ben Reed.